This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
This is Mike O'Neill here, and I was provoked into this topic by a really riveting article that just grabbed me. It was a piece by an author named Monica Potts, who wrote about her experiences in rural America, and particularly where she's living. It's a place called Van Buren County, Arkansas, and there was a to-do in the local community that involved the promotion of, like, an assistant librarian to become the full librarian and take over additional responsibilities. And there was a proposal to raise her wage from $19 an hour to $25 an hour. And there ensued a whole ruckus. And the byproduct of that was just fascinating. And it was an insight into something that attitudes in at least segments of rural America that I realized I knew nothing about. And as I thought about it, I said, you know, I not only do I not know anybody from places like this, but I'm not even sure I know anybody who knows anybody from places like this. So I put out a call and received one answer. A guest we'll bring in later, Snowden Bishop, is a podcaster and a radio host and has a background in area not unlike this. But let me tell you the rest of the story. Essentially, the ruckus over this was somebody points out that $25 an hour, that's not unreasonable. She's got a master's degree. And the response is, what do you need a master's degree to be a librarian for? I mastered the Dewey Decimal System when I was in grade school. And besides, if they want to make that kind of money, let them move to a place that, you know, that has where people make that kind of money. Whole undertones in this of kind of resentment, isolation. And the staggering thing to me was the undercurrent included a notion of not just we don't value education, but maybe even hostility towards any form of higher education. You know, what do we know about areas like this? I know the data for Arizona. I follow economic forecast of various kind. And I can tell you that over the last 10 or 15 years, job growth in rural Arizona, as it has been in much of rural America, has been very, very close to zero. You hear the figures about job growth in Arizona. Those are overwhelmingly Metro Phoenix and secondarily Metro Tucson, and that's it. So we're talking about areas that are depressed, where people leave, where wages are lower. We kind of knew that, but the overall picture of this, and I could go into the politics of that later on, but the character is anything other than a minimal government expenditure is seen as a waste of money. They have images of cities as being filled with racial minorities. I'm reading from the article right now. Racial minorities on welfare, as well as lazy urban professionals working desk jobs. and they see themselves as victims. So that's a slice of America that I got to tell you, in all honesty, I don't see every day. Snowden, give me your take on this. What does this ring true to you?
It absolutely rings true to me. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that in some of these areas, you see that there's very little growth. A lot of companies that were once industrial companies mm-hmm. have moved out of mm-hmm. areas like that. They don't hire people to do menial jobs anymore because of automation. They get better tax breaks or better profits if they take their workers and outsource them to other countries.
That's the no job growth situation.
That's the
maybe losses.
Right. Yeah. And many losses. I mean, for example, Ohio. I went to school in middle Ohio, and it once was a thriving industrial community. And from probably the
What kinds of industry was there?
Well, they had tire manufacturing. Mm-hmm. They had steel mills. They had, various.
This is not big city. This is smaller town.
This is a small town. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mansfield, Ohio. It's not a tiny town by any mm-hmm. stretch, but it's certainly. I don't even remember what the population is, but I know it's in the hundreds of thousands of people that mm-hmm. live there. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty to do, and there are industries that go in there that are, a lot of desk jobs, but mm-hmm. there once was a thriving industrial community there. And a lot of those factories are just closed. So you saw the center of downtown, which was beautiful, by the way, just completely empty storefronts. There was a lot of crime in that area. There was a lot of suburban neighborhoods that were very, very nice and a lot that were really run down. So there was a big mixed bag in that area. But I think one of the reasons why people had this, it's a typical, I don't want these things in my backyard anymore, this sort of resentment against people from bigger cities. That was prevalent.
Even though
there.
it's not like bigger city folks are moving in there.
Well, no, not at all. But and it's been a while since I've been there, so mm-hmm. in today's environment, a lot of the attitudes might be amplified or exaggerated from what they were back then. But outsiders were really not as welcome from my point of view. And I mm-hmm. was an outsider because I went to school there. My family lived somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But that was my observation back then. So, and in today's environment, I'm sure it's much worse.
Picture of how one deals with what I think is objectively a declining economic environment, coupled with this sense that there's all this wealth that's going somewhere else. Leads to, and what some of the articles, this one called it In the Land of Self-Defeat, but some of the articles have talked about, this is basically areas of great resentment.
Absolutely. Absolutely it would be. I found this really scary, this article, because when you're talking about the library, right, something that the author actually remembers that library being central to the community. Mm-hmm. It's where they held a lot of events. It's where people went after school to study. And, suddenly there's this resentment for having someone come in at a decent wage to become a librarian.
I wanted to say, hey, wait a minute, folks. When I read that, a librarian does a lot more than sort books.
Right.
They're a resource. There's somebody you go to when you're trying to look up something or find something, and that's what. But they are, by the way, an incredible resource in a community. Mm-hmm. It can be stuff that you, stuff you can't Google, or you don't know where to go, or you want to know what's definitive sources or any number of things. That's what they are, and that is not just sorting books. And you kind of want to scream at them that says, you're in an economic deprived area and you're rejecting education and the kind of the idea of knowledge. You know what? Where the prosperity goes in the 21st century, it's not coal, it's not steel, it's knowledge. Knowledge is the one thing that we have that you can take anywhere, they can't take away from you, and it is the key to prosperity.
Yeah, well, one would think anyway.
But that's not it. No, that's seems to be seen as an elitist notion that, you're one of those city folks sitting at a desk and not really working, I guess.
Well, one of the key words that I picked up on in this article was this sense of depravity. If they have to pay more taxes, they're going to have less. If they have improvements to their library, that means they're going to have to pay more taxes.
That was a theme, and I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, that we're not seeing anything as an investment, but if we're going to do anything, the first thing that comes to mind is That's coming out of my pocket.
My pocket. That's right. And despite the fact, and this is an, I think this is a universal theme these days, too. People don't want their taxes to be raised because they're afraid it's going to, you know, whatever it is that they don't realize that their taxes are going to be paying for the roads or the librarian, for yeah. example. You know, but if the librarian's making that much, how come I should pay her that much when I only make this?
You know what? That's a good breaking point. But after the break, I want to focus in on attitudes towards taxation as part of this whole nexus, and particularly as it relates to this group, though it may find echoes in other things. When we return in just a moment, talking about rural America and the land of self-defeat, and we'll be back in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We'll talk about rural belief systems, rural politics of resentment in some of our rural areas that are hurting. Snowden mentioned the issue of taxes and the attitudes towards that I found interesting. Now, of course, when you say taxes to anybody, that's inherently a negative thing because you're taking money from me for some other purpose. And you really, it doesn't make sense to ever talk about that in isolation. But you say, all right, we're taking taxes. Well, for what purpose and who gets what out of that? And what's interesting about this is I think in this case, if you're talking about taxes, certain types of taxes, certain types of – when you talk about a program – no, not even talk about tax. We're talking about a program to do X. The first thing they say is, well, this is coming out of my pocket for taxes. But in many cases, for a lot of the – take, you know, healthcare, for example, as an example – most of the money that pays for this is paid by wealthier people in other communities, and people in these communities are net beneficiaries of public spending, particularly federal spending in that area, but they're not seeing it that way.
They haven't been told that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's it goes back to the depravity again. Mm-hmm. Right? So if they have to pay taxes to pay someone else's wages or whatever, it does go to the other. It's not going to benefit the perception, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Even though, of course, it will yeah. benefit them. And you mentioned the insurance.
Well, if you said if the state or the feds set up a rural health clinic to provide better health care, yeah, they're not getting the money for that. They're getting the health care.
Right.
And essentially, when you do public programs like that, you know, those things aren't set up in Paradise Valley.
Right.
And people in Paradise Valley are net paying more than an equal share of that because that's where money is.
Exactly.
You know, their taxes are and some kinds of taxes are much better at this than that. But income taxes, for example, are mostly paid for by people with money. Other kinds of taxes, and this is also an interesting subtext, the taxes that are most favored are sales taxes, which are the most regressive taxes on earth. If you make millions of dollars, you pay that sales tax on the small percentage of your money that you actually use to buy stuff. If you're making a minimal income, you may be spending, you're likely to be spending every penny of that subject to a sales tax. And so for you, in relative terms, that is a far more expensive tax, but it is dribbled out in small amounts, and so there's kind of a false consciousness about that. They think of it as nickels and dimes.
Right.
Well, it's a dime on every dollar, but over the course of a year, for folks in a lower income group, it's a whole lot more money than the amount they pay in income taxes.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you spend 100% of your income on goods, you're paying 8% in tax.
And if you are earning 10 or 15 grand a year or $10 or $12 an hour, you are going to spend almost every penny of that on goods.
Right. Exactly.
Just to survive.
Right. Exactly. So you're right. But
But that's fancy arithmetic that, you know, is a basis of knowing that.
Well, yeah, but it all goes back to that sense of if I have to give something away, it means that I have less and already I have less. So why would I want to even consider it? And going back to what you said about the insurance issue, mm-hmm, when you consider that, like, universal health care or Medicare for mm-hmm all, people are afraid of the taxes and what that's going to cost them without realizing that every time they go to the doctor, they're paying a copay. Every time they have a procedure done, they're paying a copay. Their costs are astronomical on top of the cost of insurance.
The right question to ask is, how much is this going to cost you?
Right.
And I think most people, if they actually thought it through, really wouldn't care whether that's a tax, a copay, a premium cost, or whatever. It's the relevant question is, how much does it cost me to get health care?
Mm-hmm.
And is it going to be there when I need it?
Right. So, and this kind of leads me to a thought that I have about rural America, and that is the misinformation that they're being fed by special interests who would like them to consider that, you know, universal health care is bad.
Usually those are people who have a vested economic, and they're making a lot of money out of the current system. And if you don't spend a lot of time doing policy analysis, you can kind of get snookered on, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, you hear phrase like, government control.
Well, absolutely.
Devil's in the details. What does that actually mean? What is it going to cost overall? Not worry about, you know, it's again, taxes for what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
What do I pay in? What do I get? We'll be back with Snow and Bishop talking about rural America when we return to Think Tank in just a minute.
And sirens call them on.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are here with Snowden Bishop talking about rural America. And in the break, you raised an interesting observation about kind of susceptibility to information campaigns. Want to elaborate on that?
Well, susceptibility to misinformation. And it's not that they hear things differently than anyone else. But there's an effort for people to really get this support some of the commercial enterprises that are out there putting information in their heads, but they're not getting information from a lot of different sources the way that people in the city are getting.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of rural America, and you know because you broadcast this in some of these areas, a lot of these places have a single radio station.
Right. And so they're hearing Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham on a regular basis out of one station. And I think it's just generally true, not just in rural America, but everywhere, that people have so many options. You know, since the advent of cable television, mm-hmm. people aren't getting their news from the same place anymore. It used to be you had three networks and everyone trusted Walter Cronkite. Well, now you've got, you know, hundreds of stations and cable television.
If you have cable, that's 60% of the population.
Right. Most people do. And even in rural areas, they have cable television.
But I think the thing that's different about rural here, you're in town, you get in the car for 20 minutes, you'll catch something on the way, maybe music, maybe whatever.
Well, you have options.
But if you're in a rural area and you're liable to be commuting longer distances, driving longer distances, and you're saying with only one station available, maybe.
With one station. I mean, think about it. And people in the middle, like in the middle of Missouri, for example, they're not going to get all the stations in Kansas City or St. Louis. You know, they just don't have that kind of reach. So their exposure to different points of view are very limited. And most people these days, you can get your information online, you can get your information on cable television, or you can get your information in traditional radio, you know, terrestrial radio or whatever. But when you have options, people tend to go toward the media outlets that align with their beliefs.
That's a human trait. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's easier to sit there and nod your head than it is to get worked up.
Or have your opinions validated by the people that you respect in the media. Mm-hmm. And I think this goes to like Fox News, you know, people who gravitate toward that. It aligns with their beliefs. And then anything outside of that bubble really is something that they would reject. just as human nature. I think a lot of people do this, and it's not just rural America. But then you couple that with the fact that they're living in an area where they're not exposed to a lot of other media. They're not getting points of view from outside, from a diverse collection of sources. And, you know, these opinions just seem to, you know, magnify.
I'm thinking of the characteristics we talked about earlier. It seems to me it creates fertile ground for it. If you're an economic area of economic decline, you're not seeing a future that's better than your past. Nothing much happening in your area. Seems to me that an appeal to the politics of resentment gets cast on very fertile ground in that kind of an environment.
Yeah.
Because these are folks who objectively haven't done well.
Right. But also the world is smaller, you know, and you think about, like, I just recall my experiences living in areas like this where the gossip tends to magnify and these small issues become so large because there's really not much else to think about.
This was this case about this, you know, the case of this librarian.
Right.
You know, this was on a Facebook page, and that evidently it was like the hottest issue in town.
Well, yeah, you know? The equivalent of going viral their town, and everybody got that, and it had this emotional, there's visceral response, like, you know, a resentment response almost. Mm-hmm. But it goes back to that sense of depravity and, you know, with the losses that have already been suffered. Which are real losses. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't discount this. Mm-hmm. But why would we want to experience any more losses? And how much is this going to cost me? Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me this is going to cost a lot. So if we're paying all this money to this one person, then what's left for the rest of us?
Mm-hmm. What staggered me about the article is that you think about where everybody who's in the know, good jobs are going in the 21st century. They are all tied to higher levels of education. Mm-hmm. That there is, I think, a mythical belief that the steel mill's coming back and it's going to pay $50 an hour in the coal mines and it is not going to happen. You know, in this country, there are already the diminishment of coal miners, for example. There are more professional dancers in America than there are coal miners. Okay.
I believe it.
And if you loosen up regulations on coal, you might get a tiny little bump and slow down the decline. But it is an absolutely dying industry. And folks, if you're in a community like that, you don't want to hear that because your daddy was there and your granddaddy was there and you thought that was the future. Well, it's not. And you're ticked off about it.
Yeah. Well, this goes to a larger issue too, misinformation that's been fed to communities like this. You know, hey, we will bring back your jobs. Well, we will not.
Not those jobs. You can bring jobs, but it requires different things.
It requires thinking outside of the box, which is another thing that drives a lot of fear.
Well, when you're talking also, about realistically, if you're 55 years old and you worked in the steel mill and you had a sixth grade education, in all honesty, there may not be something for you in the future that you're like. But your kids, that's different.
Right. But in reality, there is a lot in your future if you would only think outside of the box. Climate change is one big issue that a lot of people are afraid to discuss. They think it's going to take their
They think it's taking their jobs.
But in reality, if they really embrace it and understand with outside of the information they're getting from their information bubbles, that they will have new jobs. Their costs will go down. They won't be paying as much for, you know, electricity or fuel. And it can drive a whole new economy. Same goes for hemp, for example, you know. And a lot of these areas are prime for invigoration or revitalization from some of these new industries. And because of their location and the cost of labor and everything else, chances are jobs like that would go to those communities if only they would get outside of the media bubble that they're accustomed to reviewing on a daily basis and educate themselves or allow themselves to be educated by outsiders that they resent, they might find revitalization in their communities.
And some of these things can't get outsourced. Solar installation, for example,
exactly.
has to be done by people on site. That isn't going to be outsourced to anybody.
Not to China, not to the Philippines.
You know, maybe the manufacturing, you know, but
perhaps,
we can play in the game
of parts.
We can play in the game of manufacturing.
Yeah.
But most manufacturing now is a hybrid anyway. I saw an analysis of the iPhone, for example, and all the parts come from about 26 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
They're assembled in China for the most part. Do you know who gets the – you know the where most of the money for the iPhone goes to?
No.
California. Intellectual property. The big
the
big money is the intellectual property. It's not the $3 that it takes to actually assemble the iPhone. It's the folks with advanced degrees in computer smart who figured out how to do this.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest part of, and yes, there's some low-level assembly in China. There's parts that are made, some of them they're made in 26 different countries. But the biggest chunk of the funds that from the iPhone goes straight to California.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, I just hadn't thought of it. I suppose,
you know, nor
if
did I
considered it long enough.
When I read that, I said, I didn't know that. But it does kind of make sense because
yeah. –
You know, it's an expensive thing, but it's made up of a lot of component parts. All of, you know, the low-end manufacturing of stuff can be made to be efficient. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And the least amount, the lowest cost, for example, is the Chinese who are assembling, because that's low-level assembly. There is more money in the iPhone that actually goes to Japan because they have a chunk of intellectual property mm-hmm. in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
They on the average iPhone, there's more money flowing to Japan than to China.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the physical thing of putting it together. That's our image of – and by the way, I don't think those are jobs that Americans want.
You read my mind.
Those are tedious and inherently unskilled, and in an international marketplace, a function that is not going to pay very well.
Right.
So
– Yeah,
and can occur anywhere. And there also is a movement of a lot of those kinds. China's sort of getting past that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that stuff, as they develop their infrastructure, is going to Vietnam, Bangladesh. I mean, there's a hierarchy. And mm-hmm. those kinds of things are now moving away from China because there are even lower costs.
Right.
Suppliers on the on that food chain.
And ironically, that goes to the immigration issue, too. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fear about the other. There's a lot of fear about the inner city people. There's a lot of fear about the immigration.
We'll pick that up in a concluding segment here in the Think Tank. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're here talking with Snowden Bishop about rural America, and I cut you off because the vagaries of time, but you had just raised the subject of immigration. How does that fit into this picture?
Again, I think it goes back to this sense of depravity that drives the fear of the other. And you mentioned something.
Sort of politics of scarcity.
Scarcity.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
I mean.
In other words, that's
sense of depravity.
That is a
scarcity.
An interesting, I think, way to conceptualize it. If you see the world as sort of as you see it as not as a zero sum game, you view the world quite different
from a world
that says all we have is a fixed pie, and anything you get is taken away from me.
Right.
And if that's what the world is, then I'm going to react very differently.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, and this is what a lot of the argument about international trade goes, is at a global sense, it increases the pie for everybody. It increases the size of the pie. But I think the response maybe in a lot of rural America is, yeah, but we're not getting any of that.
Exactly. And that's the point of view from which the opinions are formed, you know, to resent the global trade or globalization of anything, really. And
that,
immigration.
That steel plant in Ohio, absent global trade, might have still been there.
Possibly, so yeah.
They may have a point in describing objective reality.
Right. But what they're not realizing is that, you know, the lower cost is really impacting them in a positive way. Mm-hmm. But that's not something
right,
you think
you
about when you buy
you
a car.
You may think about when you buy a car, but if you don't have the money to buy a car, right?
Right.
But I guess I would view it as the analogy is, you know, how effective is it to try to sweep back the incoming tide with a broom?
It would be impossible to do that, number one, but I don't think it would solve their problems, you know. And I think, too, it goes back also to the misinformation that they get. They hear stories based on where they're getting their information. They're going to perceive things differently. Mm-hmm. And this goes to also the misinformation campaigns that were really targeting these vulnerable communities during the 2016 election.
All right. Describe.
Well, they'll go after certain groups and start talking about policies from the point of view of the person who's putting those policies out and describing to them why they need to embrace this policy because it's going to affect them in a certain way.
Example. Like,
okay, for example, the coal mining jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of information going out, and a lot of it was amplified by the Russian campaign, as we know, that targeted people who had lost jobs to the closure of coal plants or the automation of mm-hmm. coal and that sort of thing.
And that's a receptive audience.
And that's a receptive
folks who are ticked off.
Ticked off, vulnerable,
mm-hmm. hurting.
Economically mm-hmm. oppressed in a way.
And feel that nobody's listening.
Feel that nobody's listening. And then all of a sudden you have these, you know, bots, millions of bots amplifying information directly targeted toward them to help shape their attitudes. And then mm-hmm. that is being validated by Fox News. So this is just one example of one small segment of a group that was highly mm-hmm. targeted by a misinformation campaign that fed into the policies that were being set forth by one candidate. And then all of a sudden, that candidate becomes their savior because they're going to bring back these coal jobs. They're going to bring back economic prosperity to that specific group that was targeted by the misinformation campaign. It takes 5 minutes to get somebody into a cult, but it takes 5 years to deprogram them. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is why these opinions are so difficult to penetrate. So when someone comes in and starts talking about renewable energy and all of the resources that'll come from that or the jobs or the revitalization of their economies, they're not going to believe it because what they had been fed for so long and in such a highly targeted way formed that opinion, and everything else is an other.
And you know what else I'm thinking? I'm thinking, you know, that coal mining job, that was a real job that people had for generations.
Exactly.
And you're coming in talking about renewable energy. I haven't seen that yet. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's
right.
the unknown. It's the fear of
right.
the unknown.
It's unknown, and maybe it's pie in the sky, or you know that kind of thing. How do I know that's real?
Exactly. But then on top of that, now you have someone coming in and saying, "Oh, you don't have to pay any attention to that." And oh, by the way, climate change is a big hoax. But mm-hmm. I'm bringing your jobs back. Mm-hmm. And then you know, here we are. Their jobs aren't back. Really, they're mm-hmm. still in the same place that they were.
Because nothing has changed in the underlying structure that caused those jobs to leave in the first place.
That's exactly right. And even if the coal plants were going to open, and in fact, a couple of them probably did under, mm-hmm. you know, under the guidelines of this administration. But those jobs didn't come back. Why? Mm-hmm. Because they've got automation.
Oh, that's the other point. Far, like 10x, 100x jobs are lost by automation exactly. rather than, and that's why the number of coal miners has diminished so much.
Right.
Instead of having some guy literally with a pickaxe in there, you got a machine that's grinding out the side of a mountain.
Right. But then how do you...
Automation
exactly.
does displace jobs.
Right.
I mean, we've never had this, globally never had the law, but in a given field, you know, mm-hmm. I used to have people do data entry, and now we do web surveys, and people do it themselves, and you've obviated the need for that or things like that. But
and but we find something else that we need.
Right.
You know, we have services that we never had before.
Right. But what's unfortunate is that they don't realize that if they would just step out of the way or look at it in a more world view, they'd realize that if they embraced this notion that we can start revitalizing communities by going into things that get rid of the coal jobs. Mm-hmm. And not only are they going to have a healthier work environment, they're not going to have black lung from, you know, creating solar panels or, you know, a whole new industry, right?
But, yeah, you know, but black lung, that's something that hits me in 20 years, not tomorrow. I want a job tomorrow.
Yeah,
I'm just pointing out why it's kind of a hard sell.
Right. Well, and it's also a hard sell because mm-hmm. the validation they're getting from the media is coming from one media bubble or wherever mm-hmm. they go to get the information that aligns with their beliefs mm-hmm. and validates those core beliefs and keeps them from changing their mind and leaves them
in
a place of fear.
And furthermore, the sense that that information source is coming from folks like me and all these other sources are from, and you'll hear those are urban elites who are doing that, right?
whether they're urban elites or not, they're other.
Yeah, they're other, yeah.
They're the other. They're not, they don't know our world. Mm-hmm. They are not part of our tribe.
So who's the other urban elites?
The urban
racial
elites,
minorities,
racial minorities,
immigrants.
The immigrants, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
they're not from around here. They're not part of my world. And if I'm paying taxes to do anything that benefits them, it's hurting me. Mm-hmm. That's the mentality.
Thank you very much. By the way, I'll invite you to write in if we do have some reach in the rural communities. If we got any of this wrong or somebody would like to chime in on this, I'd love to hear from you. You can write me directly. Email O'Neill at O'Neill Research. You can catch earlier shows at ktar.com. And the even older ones and highlighting some of our best shows are all at mikeoneill.org. And we'll see you next week on a different topic in the Think Tank.
Silver cities rise, the morning lights, the streets that lead them, and sirens call them on.